Song Poker.
Welcome in, bienvenue, welcome, come on in. To this, it's only little old us. It's Song Poker with that one, Ian Martin, and me, the other one. Godly good Ian. Ian?
Hello, come in, hello.
How are we?
I'm very well. How are you?
No, how are we?
We?
Collectively.
Oh, well, I would say 50%. I'm feeling excellent, and I can see you. So I'd assume between us we have 50% excellence.
Yeah, I am pretty ragged today, I have to say. I cannot lie. I have a whacking great cold sore on the top of my lip, which is no good considering I'm opening a show in a few days and with intimate scenes.
Yes,
rehearsals are somewhat curtailed.
Unless, and here's a thought, unless you very quickly change your performance to incorporate the mask-wearing nature of, say, the Phantom of the Opera.
Well, yes, that's always a theatrical winner.
like Michael.
What music has been interfering with you this week?
Well, so let me preface this by saying that, rather like you, over the previous couple of episodes, I've not really had an awful lot of time to listen to very much. The only things I can put on the table this week are the new single from Kate Nash, which is called Change.
Right.
And the big red greatest hits of Aerosmith, which I've been listening to for some reason. I think
they've got another greatest hits.
Yes, it's about 3 or 4 years old. Obviously, Big Ones is the kind of main one we remember, and that rather glorious one from the early 80s. But they've got another one, and it's about 40 tracks. My wife loathes Aerosmith, so I sort of it's become a sort of guilty secret that you creep off to the bathroom for at 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, of course, when the members of Aerosmith were creeping off to the bathroom at 3 o'clock in the morning, they were getting a really guilty pleasure. What have you been listening to?
Well, I've just got round to watching Killers of the Flower Moon, you know, the Martin Scorsese film. Mm. And I really liked this. I really liked much of the film. I thought it was overlong, but I really loved the soundtrack. And have you seen it?
No, I read the book when it came out.
Oh, did you? Ah. Yeah. So there's this sort of near constant, really powerful, menacing underscore. Obviously, Scorsese's longtime collaborator, the late, great Robbie Robertson, who composed it. It's very percussive and inspired by, First Nation music. And I think he has ancestry that way as well. Mm. So it was really powerful. Yeah, very good. Mm. I don't know if I'd buy it on an album to listen to as such, but I did enjoy it. I also watched, though, The Greatest Night in Pop. I think I sent you a link earlier in the week because it was, I think it was released this week on Netflix. Have you seen this?
I have not, and don't spoil it for me, because I will watch that, but give me a taste of it.
I don't think it's any spoiler to say that most of them in the room were dead, are dead, rather, not were dead. Of course, it's about the making of We Are the World.
We Are the Children.
Charity song of 1985.
Yes.
Now, I've been obsessed by this song and just this idea of those greats all together in a room creating something. I mean, I wrote a sketch about it our comedy podcast a while back, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
So anyway, it's a fantastic film. Lionel Richie takes centre stage in it and sort of not narrates it, but cues everything up. It's great and you should watch it. However, it sort of got me thinking about the new works of the sort of still living contributors. And I realised to my great pleasure that Smokey Robinson has released an album in the last year. Now, Google it or Spotify it.
Yeah.
So it's called Gasms.
Good Lord. How would I be spelling that?
Oh, G-A-S-M-S.
As in orgasms?
As in gasms.
Okay, here we go. Let me just call that up.
I've had a listen once.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, so the song's called I Want to Know. By the way, Smokey's obviously still alive. He's 83.
That would explain,
That would explain his look on the front cover. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say, it's not a spoiler here, he's probably had some work.
That was my first thought, but I wonder if he's just been ironed.
I think he looks like, you know, the actress Catherine Helmond in Brazil when Jim Broadbent is stretching her face. Anyway, this song's called I Want to Know Your Body. And my particular favourite is I Fit In There.
What about You Fill Me Up? Surely.
Well, exactly. You Fill Me Up. You Fill Me Up and I Fit In There. What is going on there, Smokey?
Smokey's got a bit horny at the ripe
Well, I think he's always been pretty horny.
Well, I mean, Tracks of My Tears wasn't about fanny tracks.
No, it's true, but maybe what is I Fit In There about? I mean, I think I know what it's about, but I'd like to imagine that it's about his epilepsy, but there we are.
Bloody, so he's made what you know, if I was going to review it very cursorily, I'd say it's some sort of fisting album. It's very dirty. And he's 83.
Yeah.
Good Lord. That gives us hope for a sort of late career resurgence, doesn't it?
Indeed. And talking of horny soul singers, I've also sort of fallen into several YouTube holes recently, just sort of looking over James Brown's career.
Okay.
Because he's absolutely, obviously, a phenomenal performer. And I saw this one video, I should send it to you again, and people should look it up, it's good fun, of him on stage with B.B. King and Bobby Bland. And they're sort of just jamming and improvising, and it's very, very funny, infinitely cool. And it got me actually then onto some more B.B. King stuff. And it made me laugh, really. It made a mockery of my choice of guitarist for our supergroup episode a couple of episodes back, really, when I chose Johnny Marr. And actually, when you listen to the beauty of B.B. King playing, you've got to have him, really. Anyway, it's too late now, obviously.
Yeah, that boat has sailed. That band is now touring.
Yeah, it's going. But you know, if Johnny Marr fell ill, I'd understudy him with B.B. King.
Oh, now we're having a subs bench.
Yeah, unless he's playing chords, because he's horrible with chords. As you know. Yeah. But one more thing, sorry, just to sort of look out for, and I genuinely mean you should watch this because it's extraordinary. His performance at Sing Sing Prison.
This
Thanksgiving Day,
Brown.
1973. No, B.B. King.
B.B. King.
What a show. He goes in and performs for free, for charity, at Sing Sing, you know, the notorious New York prison, Sing Sing. He goes and does a Thanksgiving concert there. And it's like one of the great live performances of all time. Because, he's a bluesman, but there's so much humour and showmanship and wit and irony there, and the connection with these hardened criminals. There's fucking thousands of them in this hall watching and cheering, and they're going crazy for this show. It's just, it is jaw-dropping.
That sounds amazing, and I wonder if Hollywood's already making a movie of that event.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, did Walk the Line have his Johnny Cash's sort of concert at San Quentin? I can't remember.
Let's say that it did, with the caveat that I can't remember either.
No, I can't remember, but you know, much is made of that concert. But I think this is its equal, if not better.
And do you think maybe Gary Glitter, when he's got the refectory paying attention, do you think he busts out a couple of his hits just to kind of lift everyone's spirits?
I hope so, with his own inimitable style.
Yes, that would be good. And maybe Harris, when Harris was still alive, he was playing his didgeridoo and perhaps giving a quick rendition of Stairway to Heaven.
Oh, that would be lovely.
Yes.
He played at my university once during Freshers Week.
Oh, good God. Yeah. Who did he play with? Yeah.
Well, that is another story which I shouldn't probably go into, but it was common knowledge. and what he liked.
Oh, God.
Fucking horrible.
Oh, yeah. Terrible. Okay, well, we've crossed a bridge now. We've drifted into the sort of shameful world of nonce bashing. Do you fancy...
Back up over the Rubicon, please.
Yeah, let's cross that, mother. Do you fancy a quick game of song or wrong?
Oh, please. I thought of nothing else.
Right. We've got three songs before us and the bands thereby. I promise you, two of these are genuine songs. But I warn you, that one of these is a fictional song that I've made up. What I want you to do when I tell you the three songs and their artists is identify the fictional one amidst their number. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, song one is called Elevate by Quim. And that's Quim with an umlaut.
Fuck off.
Song two is called Wallop, and that's by Diplomatica. And song three, I might need a bit of a run-up for this one. Hang on. Song three is called Anus by Alaska Thunderfuck.
I don't want any of them to be false. Oh, Christ. I'll just go down the middle.
Okay.
Yeah, and say that was the fake one.
So
Diplomatica one.
Wallop by Diplomatica is indeed the fake song. So Quim, and Quim with an umlaut, is a real guy.
Right.
He's yet to put out an album, as far as I can make out. He's got a few singles on Spotify. And yes, Anus by Alaska Thunderfuck, who I presume is a character from Harry Potter. I don't know. But yeah. So
excellent.
Well done. You've won the quiz.
Thank you.
Now, I suppose we should really move into more sort of serious matters. We've gathered the listeners here. Perhaps we should get on with the meat of the crux of the body of this episode.
And what is the meat within our poking sandwich?
Well, I'm glad you asked me. It has come to my attention that some people mock the Red Hot Chili Peppers because they can't understand the profundity and the lyricism of the words. So to redress this, I thought we could host like a Red Hot Chili Peppers 101 and do a deep dive into the lyrics of perhaps their most emotionally intelligent and wisdom-laden song, Can't Stop.
Am I detecting some sort of irony here in your
Absolutely not. I think it's one of the most profound bits of poetry, if I can use that word. Poetry.
Okay. Can't Stop. So this is by the Red Hot Chili Peppers from their eighth studio album, by the way, 2002.
What a great year that may well have been.
Released February the 3rd, apparently. 21 years old.
21 years old song. But still, I think, in much the same way that the works of, say, Shelley are timeless, I think
right.
The same is true of this. So I'd like you to act as my TA for this class, if that's all right.
Okay, certainly.
I just want you to basically read us the lyrics, and I'll chime in whenever I have a footnote to share with the class.
Okay, you don't want me to read this in the style of Anthony Kiedis rapping?
I'd be very grateful if you could avoid that.
Yeah. Okay, here we go then, everyone,
okay.
From the top.
Okay.
And you're not going to give a flea-like bass line to underpin my efforts.
I'm not going to do that, but I'll warn you now. I'm going to do this when I want to cut in, okay?
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I've just about
heard that, but...
Okay,
yes.
I'll hold it right up here.
Okay, thank you.
How's that?
Very good.
Right.
Okay, here we go.
Sorry, I've got carried away. Do excuse me. In your own time.
Can't stop. Addicted to the shindig.
Now, if I can just cut in, obviously psychiatrists and psychologists have been studying the nature of addiction for over 100 years at this point, and it has to do with the brain forming attachments and receptors being activated by familiar pleasurable stimuli. Such as, say, the sweet embrace of a drug or something else that gives them pleasure. What Kiedis seems to have is that relationship, but with a spatio-temporal event, to wit, a shindig. I don't know of any parties that a brain could form that kind of attachment to. It's not as raw as nicotine. But I mean, you know, have you ever been at a party that you were literally addicted to being at?
Only if I'm on heroin.
Interesting. Anyway, so carry on.
I should say I've never actually been on heroin, so but I can imagine that it's very Moorish.
And I can imagine you on heroin.
Hmm. Okay, here we go. Yeah. And Chop Top, he says, I'm going to win big.
Sorry, couple of points here. So, Chop Top, I have consulted, you know, the other great writers from California, Bukowski, John Fante. I can't find any sign of colloquialism such as Chop Top, but I'm assuming it means like the manager of a barbershop, like the top guy in the chopping environment. So he's taking advice from his barber that something he's entered, some sort of competition, or maybe he's got a lottery ticket this week, but he's on the verge of a big win. That's what I'm taking from this.
Looking at Mr. Kiedis of the last few years, I think he's taken some very poor advice.
Do you think it was the same barber?
Possibly.
Interesting. So it's a story at once of haircutting and the possibility of redemption.
Choose not a life of imitation, distant cousin to the reservation.
Now, where to start with that? He doesn't want to spend his life imitating other people. He knows that there are a lot of people who write very straightforward lyrics, which are, you know, sort of easy to understand and perhaps be influenced by and take to heart in some ways. Not for him the easy life of imitating them. He's choosing to walk very much his own path. He's a shaman. He's a guru. He's not going to follow the crowd. He's going to write his own stories in his own words, whatever they may be. And could you just reread the second
Distant cousin to the reservation.
Yeah.
I think he discovered that he does have some First Nation heritage.
Okay.
Possibly that's a reference to that.
That's good. Know. That's good. That adds a layer of, you know, sort of social commentary.
Defunct the pistol that you pay for.
What? Who's buying a gun that doesn't work?
Well, I think in this case, defunct refers to the sort of post-punk funk fusion band Defunct.
Defunct, the pistol that you pay for. Okay, carry on.
But you know, it's always you know, if you're going to buy a cheap handgun, there's always the risk that it might not work.
That is always a risk, certainly around here.
There's real jeopardy there in this purchase of this gun.
Marvellous, marvellous. So he's bought a gun. So do we think he's planning to do a murder?
Well, who knows? He was strung out for much of his career.
Now, so he's at the barber's. He's in one of those swivelly chairs. He's having his, maybe a perm or I don't know. So he's having some hair work done. Where's he hiding a piece? Do you think he's had to do that thing you do with your wallet and your keys where you sort of put them on the side where everyone can see them?
Possibly, or perhaps it's sort of nestled within his groin under the little waterproof blankie that they give you.
Do carry on, I'm getting really quite excited already.
Thank you. This punk, the feeling that you stay for, in time, I want to be your best friend. East Side love is living on the West End.
Right. Let's look into that East and West business. Which West End, which East Side, or whichever way?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know. Do we really need to dissect it? I mean, he's an LA boy who probably dated a lot of New Yorkers in his time.
Okay.
You don't have an issue with these lyrics if, say, Neil Tennant wrote and sang it?
Well, with Tennant, you had more of a sense of the underpinning psychogeography. He'd specified it was London. You knew very clearly it was East End boys, perhaps from Stratford or Leytonstone, and West End girls.
Whereas Cadis is his approach is far more nebulous in that regard.
And it should be, because I don't think he was as, you know, obsessed with the minutiae. You know, where are you from? What's your name? That's kind of pedestrian shit.
Knocked out, but boy, you better come too. Don't die, you know the truth is some do. Go write your message on the pavement. Burn so bright.
Now, the last decent message I saw written on the pavement was... let's be honest, it was rather graphic and rather frank in its use of basic Anglo-Saxon.
Did you create it?
Yep. a rather crude rendering of male genitalia. But what he's saying is that street art can be more than that.
And this we know to be true.
Yeah.
Burn so bright, I wonder what the wave meant. White heat is screaming in the jungle. Complete the motion if you stumble. Yes.
White heat is what in the jungle?
Screaming in the jungle.
Screaming in the jungle. What are we taking from that?
If we're surmising that these lyrics and probably most of his others is about addiction, about sobriety and relapse, then perhaps white heat is the that sort of feeling of being high on smack. I don't know.
Oh, because I was wondering, is it a reference to some sort of, you know, early 80s crime film starring someone like Kurt Russell?
Interesting that you went there rather than the James Cagney White Heat film.
So this is why you're here, really, is you know more facts than I do. Could it be that Kiedis is watching this film in a jungle with the sound up really loud? And yet, of course, we have to question that fundamental truth, because did he not set this up as a kind of confessional where he's sitting in his barber's chair? Is he getting his hair cut in the jungle? You know, there's a lot going on here suddenly.
There is. There is.
It's deep.
It's dense.
Yeah.
Complete the motion if you stumble. Go ask the dust for any answers. Good God, man. You're going to press this button after every line.
I am. Now, complete the motion if you stumble. I have to sit right down. What he's saying there is that if he so much as loses his balance, he shits himself.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying. Yeah. That is what he's...
By the look of him, yeah. I'd say that was... Can I just remind you that, you know, I'm only one stanza in. I mean, if we're going to take all of these lyrics,
well,
I mean, there's some circumlocutionary work here, isn't there? I mean, it's going to take a fair old while if you're analysing everything.
Well, it might be that we do part one today and maybe come back, because I think there's a lot of material here.
And you expect our listeners to come back eager for more of this?
I'm not saying that.
This pedantry.
I think we'll make that a sort of subscribers-only extra.
Right.
This kind of content is...
Well, can I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
You know, how would you feel if these lyrics appeared on a Faith No More album, say?
Well,
because, yeah, they could have done.
No, they really couldn't. I mean, that could not have happened, because the lyrics of Faith No More, while, you know, occasionally adolescently gothic, are at least intelligible.
I say Faith No More because I know that they had some sort of puerile little spat, didn't they?
They did.
Cadis and
they did.
Whoever it was from.
Could have been any of them.
Many years.
Yeah, no, this is my fundamental thesis, is that I don't think anyone has ever got away with this kind of nonsense to the extent that the Chili Peppers have.
They've been around a long time, haven't they?
They have, and they sort of, I feel like they got together in the, late 80s or something, maybe the mid 80s even?
I think early 80s,
wow.
Yeah. I mean, they've known each other since school.
So,
yeah.
And then by the end of the 90s, all the good bands had either, you know, sort of died or broken up or whatever. And the Chili Peppers, who had always been a sort of annoying joke band, by dint of becoming the last men standing, people suddenly thought they were a credible and good band.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, they're only just standing as well. I mean, you know, there's stints in rehab. Shanti, is that how you spell it?
Yeah.
Say it.
Nice.
You know, he came and went and had dices with death. That I think they're one of the original members as well, who Anthony was at school with, overdosed. Yeah, I think they're one of those annoying bands that... They're obviously dicks, or have been dicks, in the past, but I also think that they're quite interesting for that as well, and I think they've come out the other side more reflective and thoughtful and interesting. I mean, I've not owned an album since Blood Sugar Sex Magic.
Any album at all, or just by then?
Maybe I had Californication or a bootleg of Californication at one point. I don't know. Yeah. But they're very much for me a bit like Aerosmith. You'd have the best of, but not the albums now.
No.
And I think they've got some really good tracks and some meaningful tracks as well, so I sort of dispute your fundamental thesis.
Well, what would you say were some of your favourite tracks there? Let's have maybe a top three.
Top three of the Chili Peppers, I think Scar Tissue is a great song. So I think Other Side is a good track. I think Californication's all right as well, actually. Yeah, and there's a few missteps along the way.
Lyrics. there's a song called Suck My Kiss. That's good.
That's right. That's from Blood Sugar Sex Magic. I was first introduced to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, not in person, through the film Tough Guys. You ever seen Tough Guys? Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster play two ex-cons, two hoodlums, released after like 40 years in jail, out onto the streets of 80s LA.
Good
and
Lord.
Kirk Douglas goes and buys like the sort of natty new threads and goes to a club and sort of starts meeting Dolly Birds and dancing with them, and he's like, who's the band? And it's the Red Hot Chili Peppers playing here before I think before Mother's Milk's ever released. They're sort of, you know, they're obviously got some sort of cult status, but it's unmistakably them, you know, naked and funking out. And
what's the name of that band?
It's the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You like them?
Yeah, I got all their albums.
I just remember the name standing out to me. Sorry.
What year would you have seen that?
Well, whenever Tough Guys was on TV, I assume a couple of years after it was made. So I think it was made 85, 86. So late 80s. Yeah. And then by 91, I think I was listening to them. And they were in Point Break, of course, threatening Keanu.
Kiedis and Keanu. Very difficult scene to pronounce.
Yeah. And I feel like I've stopped you mid-flow, though.
Well,
Do you want to go back to analyse? We're
sort of having a serious conversation, so let's shake it out. So did you carry on listening to the Peppers, seriously?
No, I didn't, no.
Right.
No. Certainly by the late 90s I wasn't, and then they had that sort of brief period in the early 2000s where actually, you know, they are incredibly popular, they're incredibly successful.
Yeah.
You know, they've been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't think there's any argument that they are a sort of a significant force, although the sound of their music hasn't changed a great deal over the years, over 30, 40 years or so.
That's often true of you know, most bands, I suppose, if we're being honest.
True.
Because I suppose they were a sort of, in the 90s, they were a kind of a, you know, university party night kind of, you know, song you'd always hear, kind of background noise. And then after the millennium, they had that resurgence, and Anthony wrote his autobiography.
Yes, Scar Tissue.
But I couldn't tell you really any of the music they've done in the last 10, 15 years.
And we have talked about the lyrics of someone like Michael Stipe or Tori Amos as being sort of purposefully oblique.
Yeah.
Possibly even unintelligible. But, you know, you levy that at the Red Hot Chili Peppers like that's a bad thing.
Well, I think there's a difference between something that's clever, but you really have to work at understanding it and you may or may not get there. And something where I think a man has sat down and worked out how many syllables long a line has to be and
yes,
writes that down and then makes the next line sort of rhyme with it, irrespective of what it does to the kind of sense or the thrust of the sentence that he's missed.
In fairness, though, is that not about Flea and Shanti of Chad Smith have come up with this, not the melody, but the funk, the bass line, the backing to it, and then that's given a structure, a very specific structure, that then Anthony Kiedis has to fit into.
And this, I think, is fundamentally my problem with the Chili Peppers. I think musically they're excellent. I think his voice is fantastic.
Really?
Yeah. I think he's got a really, really great singing voice. I just wish that he'd got literally anyone else on the planet, literally anyone, to write the words for him.
Literally anyone. Okay, so...
Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill. John Craven.
Michael Shard.
You know, anyone.
Yeah. Anyone. Now, I'd love to see Michael Shard dressed as Hitler... performing.
Can we just stop it there?
Being the front man to the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I mean, because they could...
I should say that's not just a fantasy of mine, by the way. Michael Shard played Hitler in quite a few movies.
Well, you say it, but you know, you've gone wading in. I think with his voice, with the music that band is capable of, they could have been one of the great, and you know, for many people they are one of the greatest bands ever, and people love them. Just for me, I just wish there was a little bit more work going on in the lyrics department, because that's kind of what my wider point is that lyrics can be so important, and when they're just sort of tossed off as a sort of afterthought. I mean, maybe that's unfair. Maybe he's worked really hard at these.
Well, maybe, but does it also speak of his upbringing? You know, he left school very young. He was trying heroin at 12, 13, whatever it was. His dad was an actor, but also drug dealer. He did not have a classical education. He's not of a literary background. You know,
sure.
Use the phrase university of life.
I'm not asking for people to kind of paraphrase Malvolio in their lyrics, but I do like a sentence. You know, I do like a cogent couple of lines where possible.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that your defence for him is that he had a similar childhood to the character Danny Kendall from Grange Hill, smacked off his bonce at the age of 12 or whatever.
And the emotional resonance with Mr. Bronson.
Yes. And that is perhaps what I was picking up on. You know, so,
Didn't
so,
Danny Kendall die in a swimming pool?
I don't know. How would he have got into the swimming pool? Did he have a sack while he was swimming? You say something. I'm actually going to look that up.
This has gone in a very strange tangential way, hasn't it?
I quite like that.
From the Red Hot Chili Peppers to a story arc in Grange Hill about 1987.
How did Danny Kendall... 1989! Good Lord. Yeah, he died in 89. He was in the show from 86. Here we go. So, yes, he was friends with Aunt Jones, Freddie Mannering, Laura Regan, Roland Browning.
Roland. Hello to our American listeners, by the way. At this point, you might be wondering what the hell we're all talking about. Grange Hill was a long-running children's drama show played after school on a weekday night with much loved and much feared characters.
So, on that subject, to give our American listeners the kind of background of what happens in an English... essentially a documentary about the things that can happen to you at school. After Mr. Bronson intervened to destroy Danny Kendall's chances of getting a job with the design company, the boy furiously confronted him before storming out of the school and stealing Bronson's car. Later, the car was discovered on an estate with Danny's dead body in the back. A post-mortem established that Danny died of natural causes due to a recurrence of his old illness. His death impacted on many at the school and led to Mr. Bronson noticeably mellowing before taking early retirement.
So he didn't die in a swimming pool? I must apologise, but maybe someone else did.
I'm sure someone must have done.
Zamo, Ziggy, whoever.
Yeah.
Who cares?
So where do you rate the Chili Peppers, like, you know, overall as a musical outfit?
When a band gets that big, that popular, and they mean a lot to a great number of people. You can't really deny that they're worth that success. I'm not sure.
I mean, are they the biggest band in the world right now? If they go out on a big world tour, are they getting?
No, I don't think so. No, they might have been sort of approaching that position at one point in their careers, but I don't think they're the biggest. But they certainly would headline a festival, wouldn't they? It would be a mighty band to knock them into second place on a festival lineup. Your image in the dictionary. This life is more than ordinary. Can I get two, maybe?
Sorry, can I just stop you again? So, the dictionary is famous for describing what words mean. It doesn't have pictures unless you're a simpleton.
Well, mine does. But
that's not a dictionary. That's. I'm not going to add to your shame.
You've always added to my shame.
Do carry on. I'm sorry.
Can I get two, maybe even three of these?
Two or three of what?
Well, I don't know.
Well, what does it refer to?
Can I get two, maybe even three of these? I don't
Condoms?
Know.
I mean, they come in threes.
But why is he asking for two, then?
He's just thinking, you know, he's had a long day. He's got an early start tomorrow. How many is he good for tonight? Two, maybe three.
So he's actually asking the chemist, condoms well, in hand, I to think, only buy two of them.
I think this is what he's saying. He's saying, look, I'll buy three, sure. But am I going to use them? Is that wasteful? There's an environmental theme of responsibility and agency happening here, I think.
Well, what kind of chemist will sell him two out of a packet of three condoms?
Well, the sort of chemist who knows how to make a quick buck. He can then sell that third condom on to, say, an embarrassed youth.
I don't know about these backstreet chemists.
they were a boy band in the 90s.
Okay, can I get two, maybe even three of these?
Sorry, that was an accident. I was just getting my dinger ready in case anything else possibly came up that we needed to discuss. Sorry, carry on.
Is your dinger ready?
The dinger's ready, mate.
My ding-a-ling. Can I get two, maybe even three of these, coming from space to teach you of the Pleiades?
Now then, who's coming from space?
It would feel like you were coming from space, perhaps, if you were on the H.
Is it a play on coming? Is it something to do with the condoms he's just bought?
I don't even like to think about
that. He's sitting in a barber's chair in the jungle, watching White Heat, while taking advice from his barber on what to bet on. And it's going to feel like he's coming from space?
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, the Pleiades refers to the star cluster, doesn't it?
Yes.
The seven sisters. Maybe he's about to use two condoms on seven sisters.
So is that 3.5 uses each? Or is that 3.5 chicks per condom?
Yeah, I think that's the way he rolls.
Or is it one condom for fronty pot? We've turned this song from whatever it was into a sort of science fiction narrative.
Or some kind of grotesque sex manual.
Or a grotesque sex manual in space. See, suddenly,
I think that's what George Lucas had.
Yeah, the original plan for Star Wars was it was basically wall-to-wall fucking. But suddenly, you know, I'm fascinated now. This song, which I, you know, have never made head nor tail of, suddenly it's now about space as well as drugs and the morality of family planning and taking gambling advice from your hairdresser.
And yet you think that his lyrics aren't deep or profound.
Well, I'm not saying that we've arrived at depth or profundity, but we've certainly discovered an awful lot of diversity of theme. You know, I'll be honest, I'm not saying this is a strength of the writing of the lyrics, but they are lively, you know, and you can sort of shake your head and go, this is nonsense. But at least it's like, I didn't see that coming. We just, after like 2 or 3 minutes of this song, we've suddenly gone into space.
I think that's about it as far as the lyrics are concerned. Oh no, can't stop the spirits when they need you. This life is more than just a read-through. I quite like that.
I think that is a genuinely good lyric, you know. It is, and he's making a point. And it's a shame you have to wade through quite a lot of preamble to get to what is undeniably there, I think, a genuine nugget of something.
Maybe he should just sing sort of two-line stanzas, like aphorisms. That's maybe what they should have created in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think, you know, with the musicianship and the tune and his voice, it could have been immense and it could have been really good. But as it is, I'm not entirely sure what he's trying to tell me.
Well, best not listen.
Well, I won't. I shan't. I might.
Yeah,
I might.
We have.
Should we have a quick round of avoiding the VOM before you kick my ass out?
Avoiding the VOM.
So, my turn to select two songs and give you the opportunity to blast one of them into space, never to be heard of again. Are we blasting it into space on the same spaceship that Anthony Kiedis is having his hair cut?
No, I don't believe so. I think he's coming from space.
He's coming from... So, right, okay, so very careful to make sure they don't hit each other. So we're just loading it into, like, one of those little tiny nose cone capsules that gets blasted into space rather than, say, a shuttle or anything larger. I just want to get, you know, like a picture in my mind of what we're doing here.
It needn't be big. I mean, it could fit in the jock strap of the next astronaut in space.
Okay. But as long as he winds down the window, flings the song out into the unspeakable barrenosity of the cosmos, and we never hear that song again.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, super. So what I've plumped for this episode's Voiding the VOM, two songs which I think represent perhaps the very worst things that happened in the 1990s, musically, culturally. And I feel like I'm setting you a genuine dilemma here to choose which one above all others to banish. Mm. So your first choice for your consideration is the, I believe, number one single, but I could be wrong, Vindaloo by Fat Les.
Yes, hateful.
Despicable. Despicable.
Despicable, yes, and I think everyone involved in that should be jettisoned
your favourite people. You've got Keith Allen.
Whose brainchild it was, I believe.
Yeah, you've got Alex James.
Yeah.
That's as far as I know, but if you know anyone else associated with the record. I believe it was kind of created when they were all pissed in the Groucho Club.
Yeah,
came up with the idea.
Yeah, so it's Damien Hirst as well, isn't it?
Of course, it was Hirst. Yeah, he was probably suggesting he saw one of them in half and have them trapped in formaldehyde.
Yeah, but David Walliams was in the video along with Paul Kay.
Oh.
I mean, I quite like Matt Lucas, but he was in the video.
So Fat Les, option one, right? I don't think I need to make a case for that. I think that's almost itching to be blasted into the ionosphere. But before we can sign off on that, for your consideration is option number two. It's a song called All for Love by Sting, Rod Stewart and Bryan Adams.
What? I think that was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was part of a soundtrack to a 90s
Robin
or early
Hood?
2000s film. No, it was Three Musketeers, was it? Or Man in the Iron Mask,
yeah,
one of those.
Three Musketeers. Must have been, yeah.
Yes, that song, dreadful.
Yes.
Housewife's favourite nonsense. Yep. However, to my mind, there's only really one choice here. It's not a genuine dilemma. Fat Les has to go. Anything that's sung on the terraces by that amount of drunken, let's face it, men.
Yep.
There was probably an intended irony in the song, but...
Possibly.
But no one on the terraces really appreciates that.
I've never witnessed this happening, but I can imagine that the sort of men who bellow this on the terrace would then have gone for a curry... and cheerfully sung this to the staff in the restaurant, meaning it as a sort of camaraderie kind of display of friendship and aren't we all lovely. But it's despicable.
Ill-advised.
Yeah.
Let's get that fucker into space.
So Fat Les, so Alan, James, Hirst, Walliams, we'll save Lucas. But the rest of them, are they going in the rocket too?
I don't see any reason why not, although they might have trouble fitting in the jockstrap.
At this point, I'm going to say let's utilise a fairly standard size rocket. Now, just in passing, they're already in a sort of metal tank. At the point we're putting them in a rocket, should we fill that with formaldehyde and saw them in half?
Oh, that's a lovely idea. Yeah.
Presumably one day this rocket will be discovered by an alien race. We've given them a fairly valuable artwork as a sort of gift.
Yeah, pricks divided.
That was a website I was on before Facebook.
Voiding the VOM.
9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Marvellous. Okay, well, that was great. I feel like next time we should do something different. In the meantime, enjoy some Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I'm gonna go to Waitrose now and possibly with me dad and my nan and my gran.
Excellent.
Go off for a vindaloo.
Yes, and with some Red Hot Chilies in it.
Yeah.
Excellent. It all links. Isn't music great?
Toodle pip, everyone.
Cheery bum. Song Poker was produced by Electric Sodcast Studios.
This is where you tell me all about how locals rule and yuppie insects like me shouldn't be surfing the break and all that, right?
Nope. That would be a waste of time.
We're just gonna fuck you up.